everybody, welcome back to the Memories of Dallas show, part of the Memories Inc. network of shows. This is a show where we talk about all the people, places, and things related to Big D, Dallas, Texas.
Today, we have part two of the interview between Louise Key and Saren Groom Knight, daughter of Dewey Groom, of the Longhorn Ballroom.
Memories of Dallas is made possible through the generous support of Toothacres Pet Care Center. Toothacres is located in Carrollton, Texas at 1639 Parker Road. Toothacres Pet Care Center provides the finest indoor and outdoor boarding environment for your pet. With over 45 years of experience, the Clem family has created and maintained the highest level of excellence in the pet care industry. And they do it because they're pet owners too. For all your boarding needs, choose Toothacres. Toothacres offers cat and dog boarding as well as cremation and burial. You can reach them on the phone at 972-492-3711 or go to toothacres.com. And when you go, be sure to thank Lori Clem and the entire staff at Toothacres for supporting Memories of Dallas.
Going back to the 60s, you know, before Willie became Willie, when he was clean-cut Willie, you know, he had an unusual style and phrasing, an incredible songwriter. Nobody can top Willie Nelson for songwriting, and Kris Kristofferson maybe, but he needed work, and usually on Sundays, Dad only just had the house band, but occasionally he would book in people just kind of help them out. And, you know, they didn't necessarily draw anybody, but they didn't take anybody away. And he'd pay Willie like $50 just to come in on a Sunday to, you know, help him out. But Willie never forgot that. And Willie never turned Dad down, to my knowledge, that if they had a date and they wanted to book it, they'd say, let's go down to Dewey's place. And I remember one night, this was still in the clean cut day, so it would have been late 60s, that there was kind of three offices in a row, and I must have been 10 or 12. And again, it was just, we were always down there. We didn't think anything about it. So I was like in the middle office, sitting at the desk, and I looked up. This really tall guy comes in, and I knew Willie Nelson, and he had on a little black coat and black tie, and there was three of them, and I thought, that's Don Meredith. So, and that's when he was the quarterback for the Cowboys. So it was Willie Nelson was hanging out with Don Meredith, and it must have been Texas OU weekend, because what was that, Don? I'm trying to think of the Texas OU coach that was there forever.
Oh, I know who you're talking
about.
Yeah.
Again, it's like that other thing. I just went blank. If I hadn't tried to tell the story, I'd have remembered it. Anyway, they all three came in.
Daryl Royal. Royal.
That's yes. And went in Dad's office, and he had it was a sliding door, and, you know, so open the door and then slide it back, and in a little bit, you'd hear them laughing. I know they were all in there laughing and drinking and telling stories. And it probably was Texas OU weekend, I'm sure. That's why, you know, Daryl Royal was in town, and it was all over. And hopefully it was one of the times that Texas won. But that wasn't unusual to see people like that come in. And of course, then there's the Mick Jagger story.
Oh, yeah, you want to tell that one?
Yeah, might as well. It's already on Facebook now. I kept it to myself for 40 years because I thought, you are so stupid. It's like, how stupid can you be? I'm so stupid that I didn't know who Mick Jagger was. That's how stupid I am. Again, it was on Monday nights, we were typically closed. But for years, ever since I can remember, Dad would lease the club out to John Henry Branch, I believe was his name. All Dad did was just rent the club out, and then Mr. Branch would book whoever we didn't have anything to do with who they booked. And I thought it was B.B. King, but I had two people call me and say it was really Bobby Blue Bland that was playing at the Longhorn that night. And that's when I was working a bar, and we were busy, man, we were busy. And it kind of goes back to the safe, of the Dewey safe and the Jack safe. Well, the one that we called Dewey safe would be like the operating change. You know, if we needed something, we'd go buy a roll of quarters out of it or what have you. And, of course, I was probably the only one that could get in there to do it. And like I said, we were busy. I believe beer was 75 cents or 220. I believe it was 225. We were going through 75 cents and change, you know, thousands of times over and over. So you go through a lot of quarters. Well, I went back to the office because we had to have quarters. So, and, you know, you got to remember, every 10 seconds, you'd be ringing up a sale. So seconds counted. And we all knew, you know, that job is to make money. Or none of us have a job. And so I went to the office, and there was my brother sitting there, my brother Doug, and another guy in a white suit, and I think my sister-in-law was on one side and Dad at the desk. And yeah, again, I wasn't really thinking. I was just, man, I was going to run in there and be in and out in 10 seconds. And my brother Doug stopped me and said, well, aren't you going to say hello? And I was like, well, why don't I have to say hello to you? I see you every day. And he said, don't you know who this is? And I was like, looked at him, man, he looks familiar, but hell, I don't know. Yeah, I was involved in horses, and I rodeoed and rode junior bulls in high school. So I wasn't up on the rock and roll world at that time. And now if it had been Merle Haggard or Willie Nelson sitting there, I'd have known right off. But he said, don't you know who this is? And I was like, nope. And he said, well, this is Mick Jagger. And I didn't hear the Mick. I just heard Jagger. And this is the embarrassing part to me. What's funny, my insurance agent was named Ronnie Jaggers. He's still my insurance agent since 1978. You know, he probably ought to get a commission off of this story. But I said, well, are you any kin to Ronnie Jaggers? And he's like, he had that English, no. And then he kind of put his head down. And I thought, well, you, I'll be nice. I thought, well, aren't you being rude? And he said, my brother Doug said, well, haven't you heard of the Stones? And I can't say exactly what he said because it wouldn't be fit for public consumption. And I said, of course, you know, they hadn't been the Stones that long at that point. And I was like, you know, again, all I'm thinking is I got to get back to work. You know, I don't have time for small talk and thinking. And they were like, oh, no, I don't know. It seemed like something. He said, the Rolling Blankety Blankety Blank Stones. And I said, well, yeah, sure. Everybody knows who the Rolling Stones are. And he said, then my brother Doug said, well, this is him. And I was like, it's a pleasure to meet you, sir. Excuse me, I have to go back to work now. You know, I'm not in here to fraternize, and the famous people to this day, they don't faze me, you know. But anyway, so I just politely, you know, said, you know, it's a pleasure to meet you, sir. If you'll excuse me, I got to get some change and go back to work. And, you know, he probably remembers me because he looked at me like, well, you don't know who I am. Well, you're a pompous ass. But anyway.
I wonder if he was visiting his wife's family. You remember, you know?
Oh, yeah, that. I believe they had a concert in Fort Worth the next night. And Mick Jagger's a big blues fan. So when he saw that, you know, that Bobby Blue Bland was going to be there, I have found out since I told that story that his people called our people. And that's how we found out ahead of time. Because my brother called a couple of his friends and said, man, Mick Jagger's going to be here tonight. And they're like, yeah, right, Doug. And sure enough, he was. And they stayed home.
They didn't go.
Mm-mm.
But they regret that now.
Yeah, and they're the one that told me it was Bobby Blue Bland. So I was like, okay.
You tell on the Facebook page that there's a story about John Wayne that you might divulge at some point. Do you want to divulge that now? Is that
I was busy with grandkids or something. It wasn't really a very interesting story. For the grand opening of True Grit, the premiere, I guess, was in Dallas, and they had a parade, and Dad was the band, the Longhorn Band was to play, and John Wayne was on. It was before the parade started, and I guess I was by the band trailer or something, and I saw John Wayne standing there, and I ran out to him because I was 10, and asked for his autograph, and he was nice. They had some like little autograph cards made up, and they handed them out. And because I meant this was still like a behind the scenes thing, the public couldn't get to where we were. But so I got John Wayne's autograph and met him. But that was pretty cool. I did like John Wayne.
He was a big star back then,
yes,
and still
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely,
still is. What do you remember about Bob Wills?
I remember him calling the house, and thinking back.
What was it?
And seeing him on stage a time or two. And the night, and I don't have the years in my head, but whatever night it was that they were doing the For the Last Time album at Summit Burnett Studios. And Bob had a stroke that night, and he ended up in a nursing home in Fort Worth before he died. And I remember Mom and Dad and me, I don't know why they drugged me everywhere, but they did. My brother's got to stay home riding motorcycles. And of course, now I guess I look back and go, well, I guess it's a cool thing to do. But we went to that nursing home and saw Bob Wills. And of course, I was 13, 14 maybe, I don't know. I hadn't been in that kind of situation. And personally, it was kind of unnerving. But Dad talked to him a little bit. I mean, and I don't think Bob was able to say much, but I believe he understood and knew we were there. And I remember Dad saying something about once a man, twice a child. And I didn't understand that at that age. And I remember, that this is, the greatest man in country music laying here, and don't remember him like this. Remember all the wonderful, great things he's done and what a good man he was. And now he's in diapers for the second time. But
what was his personality like? Do you remember him? Did he interact with you, or?
Not that I can recall. I mean, other than, hey kid, how you doing,
You were little then.
Yeah.
You talked a little bit about George Strait a minute ago, and you have another story about George Strait, right? Is there more to the story about George Strait?
The first time we had him. Was unwound, actually when we booked him, Unwound hadn't even been released yet. And we were all like, who is George Strait? Why are you booking him? Because, again, he wasn't in the top 40. Who is this guy? And occasionally something like that would happen if an artist was just trying to pick up a date, on their way from Dallas to Houston or Oklahoma City to Houston or something. But so the first night that George played, and then after we started doing the advertisement, let me back up a little bit, the phone just started ringing, and we were like, wow, what is all this? All these younger people coming in and buying George Strait tickets, and I think they were $8. They might not have even been that much. They weren't any more than that. And Remember me telling you about how we had the divider? Well, we didn't open it that night because we didn't expect to have 300 or 400 people. Well, we ended up having 800 to 1,000. I don't remember exactly. But it wasn't long that everybody said, well, we got to open the curtain. Well, it wasn't prepared. I mean, there wasn't tablecloths on the tables, and the chairs weren't all lined up pretty with, you know, nice red candles and stuff. So we all had to run back there and get it ready right quick so we could get it open. And then I guess I went back to the bar to work, and so I'm trying to get the time. Usually the band would go on at 8:30 to 9, and they'd play about an hour, and then the star would go on about 10:30 for their first show, and then again around 1 a.m. And Dad buzzed me again and said, I need you to come in here and pay this fella. So I said, okay. So I told somebody to watch my station, and went in into the office, and George Drake was sitting there, a young guy, nice and polite, and didn't really say anything. And then his manager, I believe his name was Ray Baker, if I remember right, and I believe he was his bass player also, was sitting there. And again, remember me telling you how Dad would go out in the audience and he would sit with all the people? Well, every one of them would pour him a drink. So sometime later on in the night, that's why he would call me to do the thinking and counting. And he said, I need you to pay these people. Pay this fellow George Drake. I said, okay. So he said that in front of me, and he handed me a stack of $100 bills. And so I count them out, stacks of 1,000 to 10,000. He made $10,000 that night. And so I counted them out, you know, and you do everything up front where Bangsy is, to be honest. So I gave it to Ray Baker and the manager, and he says, okay. So he takes it and he double checks it, fine with me. And so he takes that $10,000 and puts a couple of bands around it and takes it in a grocery sack, paper grocery sack. And he wraps it up and kind of throws it up under his arm, and he looks over at George and he said, okay, we're paid, we'll go do the second show now.
That was only the first show that night.
That was the first show.
I wonder where
and the first time he had played there. So, you know, club owners are notorious for cheating the bands and artists. And again, that was the first time they were there, and they didn't really know what to expect. And he went out and did the next show. And I look back and go, I didn't even know who I was paying that night. Didn't matter.
Well, yeah. I would think $10,000 was a lot of money back in those days.
That was, yeah. Conway Twitty made that. We had a house fire back in 09, and I used to have a lot of the old contracts. But my, you know, Hank Jr., Mo Bandy, Conway Twitty. I don't know if there was a Haggard in there. There might have been, but I didn't pay much attention to him at the time, and now, man, I wish I had those. But
what about Loretta Lynn? Do you remember her? Because they're mostly men, but yeah. Here you've got Loretta here.
Yeah, actually, Dad's theory, and I'm not saying I agree with it, I'm just saying this was his, and the era that he grew up in. His opinion was most women don't want to go pay to see another woman in the 60s and 70s. And so there were few women. Loretta Lynn was booked often. Tammy Wynette, Connie Smith, Kitty Wells. But by and large, all the other little up-and-comers, even the more established women artists would get booked. And Loretta played there quite often. And one night, my mom told me this story. I don't guess I was there that night. So I'm going to say it had to be maybe the early 70s, maybe the late 60s. But Loretta did her show, and after all the people had left, And there was a side door out of the office, and Mom went outside, and you know, back then women wore them high heels, and those, you were lifted and tucked everywhere, and you know, you worked hard all night and your feet hurt, everything hurt. So Mom just kind of sat out on the sidewalk there and took her shoes off, just, you know, wiggle her toes a little bit, and Loretta come by and looked out and said, "Boy, that looks good." I said, "You care if I join you?" So, you know, to the world, you got Loretta Lynn and Quinlan Groom, who were names, but at this moment in time, they're just two mamas who've been working hard all day, and they want to let their feet air out. And they probably talked about, wish they had a bowl of beans at home or something, you know? But they were just regular people at that stage, at that point in time. And I think that's what's so great about, we got to see people, you know, you got the public persona, and then we got to see the real people. You know, Ernest Tubb and Conway Twitty were people that would stay there and until 4 o'clock in the morning if need be. Nobody left that wanted an autographed picture or to buy an album or just shake their hand and say thank you for your music. They stayed for them. They loved their fans. And Loretta and Ernest Tubb and Conway Twitty and Mel Tillis would do that. There was a lot of them that they just didn't have the time because they had to hurry up and get to the next job. But others would just, you know, they loved the country music people, and they knew that was their fans and their audience, and they appreciated them. Otherwise, they'd be picking cotton again, you know, so they'd much rather pick a guitar.
So one of the most infamous stories, you know what I'm going to talk about, 1978? The Sex Pistols, were you there that night?
Yes, I was there.
Okay, you got to tell your version of it, please.
Okay.
My name is Paul Heckman. I am the Executive Director of Memories Incorporated, an IRS-approved 501c3 nonprofit. A few years ago, we saw a niche for Facebook pages free of politics and created our first page, Memories of Dallas, which is now well over 30,000 members strong. We have expanded our Facebook pages to include Memories of Texas, Memories of Texas Football, and Memories of Texas Music. We also have actual web pages for memoriesofdallas.org, memoriesoftexas.org, memoriesoftexasfootball.org, and meminc.org, our mothership. We are working on additional web pages now. Please come see us.
Are you looking for a podcast network that talks Texas by Texans? Well, check us out. You're already listening to us, but go to the website, LoneStarPodcast.com. You can also find us on every big podcast platform, LSPN. We have shows in business, entertainment, marketing, music, of course, sports. We have some of the best sports podcasts in the state of Texas, ranging from high school football all the way up to pro basketball. So check us out online, LoneStarPodcast.com. That's the LSPN on every major podcast platform.
So one of the most infamous stories, you know what I'm going to talk about, 1978, the Sex Pistols, were you there that night?
Yes, I was there.
Okay, you got to tell your version of it, please.
Okay, well, the whole Sex Pistols thing came about, remember me telling you that on Monday nights we would rent out the club, and if I remember correctly, it was Stone City Attractions out of San Antonio, called my brother Doug, he was doing... By that point, he was doing most of the booking instead of Dad. I said, we want to rent the club that Monday or Tuesday. I'm not even sure what it was. And he was like, okay. And I don't even know if he asked who they were going to have. But I do remember my brother Doug saying that either... It was kind of a conflict just because we had... Maybe somebody big the day before, or the day after, or that week, and it was just going to be a hassle, and he didn't really want to do it. So he thought, well, I'll charge them double or triple, and they'll say no, and everybody will go off their own merry way. Well, they said yes. So, darn it. And And then a few weeks before the show, all these radio people in England and everywhere started calling, going, why are you having the Sex Pistols, and do you know what they do? And of course, again, you know, Dad's just an old country boy, and he treats people fair, and you don't cuss in front of the women folk, and you know, you don't have bad manners. And when he started finding out what they would do, he tried to cancel it. Well, of course, they're not going to let them cancel it. You know, they got you dead to rights. There's nothing we can do, you know, from that standpoint. And so, again, I was working the bar that night, and the only thing we would sell, because we had heard that people come in and they, you know, they'll throw up on the floor, they'll pop a head off a chicken, or, you know, who knows? We heard all kinds of crazy stuff. But it was agreed that instead of selling bottle and cans, we would only sell draft beer. We would only sell draft beer in a plastic cup. So if they did start doing all this crazy stuff, then they wouldn't, you can't hardly hurt yourself with the Coors cup. But I just remember it being loud. I didn't understand what they were saying. And I didn't get to watch too much of the show again because we were busy and my job was to sell beer and I was selling lots of beer. And I just know when it was over and everything left that, you know, the dance floor was just covered in, yuck. I mean, I don't know what they did on the dance floor, but probably every vile thing you could think of was on the dance floor and on the stage. And, you know, we had to get it all cleaned up, you know, for the next night. And we were just glad that business was over with. And I know everybody makes a big deal about the Sex Pistols being there and that marquee that happened to have Merle Haggard under it. Which that could have been the same night. I don't even remember that we had to do the refund. But nonetheless, I mean, it happened by accident, and we couldn't get out of it. And they never played there again, or anywhere else, I think, for that matter.
Do you think your dad regrets having him there?
Oh, absolutely. I know he does. That's not the kind of publicity he would have ever wanted. And again, you know, you're just taking... He didn't know stuff like that even existed. And they might have been one of the first ones. I mean, again, I don't know who Mick Jagger is, but but you wouldn't know about George Jones or Merle Haggard. You know, we could hook you up. But so we certainly didn't know what the Sex Pistols were doing and what their type of show was and the things they said and did. But we got roped into it and couldn't get out of it. That's the true story of what happened, how the Sex Pistols got at the Longhorn Ballroom.
Do you remember any... Were you there on the nights that they was rented out to other... to the...
Oftentimes, yes.
So do you remember Nat King Cole? Or, you know, any of those singers?
I don't
singers
recall that... Nat King Cole ever playing there.
Oh, okay.
He may have, but not to my knowledge. Now, Ray Charles was there. B.B. King and Buddy Guy and Bobby Blue Bland. They were there a lot. Johnny Taylor, ZZ Hill. Yeah, and I love... That's when I really discovered that I had blues music in my soul. And I've been a blues fan ever since, because that was the first time I was really exposed to the blues masters. Now, of course, at the time I didn't realize that, you know,
the Longhorn Ballroom was kind of ahead of its time, having those singers there.
Yeah,
I would.
Yeah, and again, not making this to sound racist by any means, but right now today, if you booked all those people, your audience would probably be 90% white. But back then, it was 98% black. There were it really wasn't a crossover. In my opinion, and again, this is just my opinion, I believe Stevie Ray Vaughan opened up that whole blues genre to a whole nother race and culture that weren't a part of it. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time to be there at the beginning, not necessarily of the blues, because that had been forever, but I was able to see it in its most natural element, I believe, would be the only way I could describe it. Instead of the kind of the washed down version that people are getting nowadays. And that's just from a musical standpoint, that not anything else.
So your dad sold the Longhorn Ballroom in 85.
Actually, it was 86. Okay. The last night was New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1985, which was the night that Ricky Nelson was killed in a plane crash, too. And another aside, the actual sale didn't go through until a few months later. And the first person that bought it was named Ira Zach, who at that time owned the Bell Star Dance Hall over by North Park. It used to be the Bavarian Steakhouse, I believe it was, back in the, that would be 70s and 80s, I guess.
So what was life like after you all sold the ballroom? Because it was so much a part of your lives before that. How did it change?
When I had my daughter in 83, again, my husband's a musician. They say you marry your dad. And I get looking back, he's a musician in the country music business. He's 9 years older than me. Daddy was almost at the mom. And when I had my daughter in July of 83, I was tired of the nightclub business. Honestly, I could have cared less about the Longhorn at that point. And I remember specifically telling everybody, there will not be a third generation in this business. I'll do whatever I have to do, but I am not going to raise my kids in a honky-tonk like me and my brothers were raised. Not that it was necessarily a bad thing, but it wasn't Leave It to Beaver, you know? And that's what I wanted for my family, my kids. And when Daddy sold it, it was like kind of good riddance, you know. And I honestly felt that way for probably at least 15 years. People would contact me, and I don't miss coming in at 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't miss having a backwards life. I want to get up and have Thanksgiving dinner, you know, with, and not have to get up and go to work. I wanted a normal existence. And so in that respect, I personally was like, whatever, that, you know, I'll go find a job somewhere, I'll do something else. But then after that kind of ran its course, and it took a long while, I said at least probably 15 years, and I was older, and I would realize that I was a part of history. And not wanting to be in the nightclub business doesn't take that away. And that I don't need to look at all the negative things that came out of the nightclub business. Because we tell stories of the good stuff. We don't tell stories of the bad stuff. And I won't. But I still didn't want that lifestyle, and I didn't regret so much it being sold. Mom and Dad had worked hard their whole lives, and they were ready to retire. And you know, it's a business that takes a lot out of you.
I would think it's one of those 24/7
jobs. Yeah, you know, that's a good point. I also realized then, because it is a 24/7 job, you didn't have weekends, you didn't have holidays, you couldn't go to your kids' school functions because you were always working, entertaining everybody else. And And I said, I don't ever want to be self-employed. I want to work for somebody else, and I know what my check's going to be every week, and I know what my hours are going to be, and I don't want to live like, yeah, you might make good money this week, but next week you might lose your fanny, and nobody gets a check, because there were some weeks that I didn't get paid either, you know, but that's how it is when you own a business, regardless of what your business is.
You don't want to tell one of the better bad parts of
bad parts.
Well, you don't have to tell the worst part of living there. Working there.
Better bad part. Like I said, mostly, and I guess I didn't realize it until, like I said, I had a kid, how backwards a life it was, because I didn't know any better growing up. I thought everybody's dad worked at night, and that was a way of life that I thought was normal until I got older and I had my own kid, and I'm like, I don't want to raise her like that. And so in that respect, you know, that was bad to me.
After your dad sold the ballroom, or maybe before then, he became really involved in a home for special needs kids?
Oh yeah, before, in the 60s.
How did that come about? What piqued his interest in that?
He was always a very tender-hearted man, and he had a nephew that was born with special needs. And you got to remember, at that time, those kids couldn't go to public school. You know, there were no accommodations for them. Nobody was even considering it. And so he helped establish or support a school called Angels Incorporated, and it provided a place for the kids to go to school, and the parents, you know, to get a break, and they would learn to sit at a table if they could, or if they were in wheelchairs or on walkers or canes or whatever the case may be. Stuff we wouldn't even think about today, much like the race situation. We look at it now and go, well, that was so absurd. You know, why couldn't a kid that's in a wheelchair be able to go to public school? But he couldn't, you know? And, of course, when all that changed, you didn't need the Angels Incorporated anymore.
Was good. Yeah, that was good. Is that when it go kind of out of business, to speak, at that point?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, we're going to wind down for now. Maybe we can talk about if there are any other stories on another day, but is there anything that you've seen in print or out there in the public about the ballroom or your father, Dewey Groom, that you'd just like to put on the record that was incorrect and tell the truth about?
Well, there's one floating around that has it as Dewey Douglas Groom, and I have no idea where that came from. Dewey Groom was my father. Douglas Groom was my brother. Dewey Groom's firstborn son, but they're not the same person. And there's a lot of stories out there floating around that Dad actually bought it from Bob Wills, but he did not buy it from Bob Wills. O.L. Nelms built it for Bob Wills, and then after a couple of years, that ran its course. But O.L. Nelms owned the real property, not Bob Wills.
Bob Wills was a musician, not
yeah.
a...
yeah, he had the business until it went out of business, and then it was just a building.
So this is not really an oral history question, but I'd be curious. What do you think your dad would think about country music today?
He would ask where it went.
What?
He would ask where it went, because this is not country music. And again, memory telling you, if you can't dance to it, you can't dance to this stuff. Everything sounds the same. It's a tractor or a dirt road or, you know.
Kacey Musgraves, she's kind of soulful, right, in a way. But you can't dance to her.
Quite honestly, I couldn't even, when they have the commercial for the CMAs and stuff, I haven't watched it in probably since 20 years, 25 years. because I don't know who those people are. The other ones, I could go, oh, look, you know, there's George Strait. I paid him. There's George Jones. I've been on his bus. Oh, look, there's Johnny Rodriguez. I got thrown off his bus.
Okay. Can we do this again?
Okay.
Because you've mentioned two stories that you haven't told, and, you know, it's been an hour and a half, so.
Okay.
Which is fine. I'm happy to keep going, but I think maybe for both of us with a fresh mind, maybe we could do it again another day. Is that okay?
Yeah, I should... Let me finish one story, because it really is a very good one. It involved Dad and Willie Nelson, and it was, let's see, I was married, I'd been 78 or 79, and Willie was, I don't know if Willie was booked at the club, he probably was, and then Willie asked Dad to come over to the hotel with them and, I guess, party or hang out or whatever old guys do in the late 70s. And so when everybody left, Dad's car was still at the club. We didn't really think too much about it. And then the next day, like about 10 o'clock or so in the morning, Dad called me and said, he had that real gravelly voice, I need you to come pick me up. All right, Daddy, where you at? I'm out here at the Holiday Inn in Garland with Willie. I said, well, what are you doing out there? He said, oh, I don't know. We came out here to party, and now I don't have a way home. I was like, okay. So I lived in Dallas County at the time. So once again, he calls and said, jump, and I just say, how high, because that's my job. So I get up. I tell my husband, Junior, she said, where are you going? I said, I got to go pick up Daddy. He's been hanging out with Willie Nelson all night. And he doesn't have a way home. So he said, you want me to go with you? I said, nah, I'm all right. So I went, pulled up in front of the hotel, Daddy get in. He looked like 10 miles of hard road. And the first thing he says was, I ain't smoking any of that shit anymore. And I thought, see, I'm 22, 3 years old, and I'm picking up my dad after partying and smoking pot all night with Willie Nelson. This is supposed to be backwards. I'm supposed to be calling him to come pick up me from hanging out with my friends doing stuff. And but anyway, I can't help but think. But he didn't go smoke any more of that stuff with Willie. But that's why I don't know who all was with Willie. I know the band. And I don't know if Charlie Pride was there with them that night or not. I know he was at one time at an after party, but... anyway, I think that's pretty funny. Dad smoking pot with Willie Nelson
and
all night.
Willie's still doing it, I think, right? Or maybe I heard he's not doing it as much, something like that. Anything I forgot to ask?
No, I can't think of anything. It may come to me later.
And is there anything you want to add before we sign off today?
No, I'm good.
Thank you so much. This is just fascinating. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Ann's first song, Blue, came out in April, probably in 96. I know it was 96. And, you know, nobody had heard a kid sound like that Patsy Cline voice. And
she was, what, 12 or 13 then? I remember.
At that time,
yeah,
she was 13, yeah. And, she had, Milo Deering was her steel player at the time when they were playing mostly local shows. And all most of the rest of the guys were all still from around here that my husband Junior had been playing with off and on for years, you know. Incredible, incredible musicians. And then when Leanne started getting all these bookings, I mean, all over the United States, because all that stuff hit so big, Milo called Junior up and said, I got too many things going. I got 3 little kids at home, and he was real involved in session work, and his wife was something in the TV commercial. I don't know really what all she did. I just know that it helped him with a lot of connections. He had incredible talent. And And he said, I'm not going to go on the road that long. Are you interested in it? And so I thought, well, you know, I've seen all these fly-by-night people come and go. I said, I don't know if I want him to get involved in all that, because I got two little kids at home. By that time, Mom and Dad were sick. And I was living next door taking care of them and horses and kids and working a social work job. So I'm trying to get back into gear here. Flashback. So I went, Leanne was booked at Billy Bob's, and I went, I think I just went by myself. I might have had a friend, but I think I went by myself, just incognito. And I didn't tell anybody, and you know, I didn't want to go up and say anything to any of the guys in the band that I knew. And I just got in the very back, and I just watched, and I observed the people and how she related with them and how she sang and the band and the way her management team approached things. Again, I play stupid, but I'm not. And so it passed muster with me, and so I went back and told you, I said, well, if you know what happened, because I don't know who he was working with at the time. Who knows? Like Gary Stewart, Ray Price, somebody. And I said, well, if the job comes open, I said, this kid's going somewhere. I said, this kid's going to blow the doors off, you know. And if that's what you want to do, then me and the kids will hold down the fort, because you're going to be gone 6 months, you know. And so he did. And they called him and said, can you leave, like, 3 days notice or something. Mm. I was like, you don't have enough underwear to go off for 2 weeks. I said, I gotta go to the store and buy you some. I mean, because they would go off usually 3 weeks, come home for 2 or 3 days, just enough that you would need another change of clothes to go out. And, you know, I'm talking about starts jeans, you know, starts shirts, the jackets, you know, you gotta look good on stage. Not like today, where they come up and, you know, not much more than boxer shorts and a raggedy t-shirt. But, so, you know, I would get all of this one stuff cleaned into the cleaners and have one little spot, so this is your road stuff, and he'd throw the dirty down and grab the clean and say hi to the kids, and off we go again for another 2 or 3 weeks. The first 6 months, they worked 180 shows, which means there was several that were, you know, 2 or 3 day mm-hmm. shows. And some of those were TV shows, and some of those were flying to New York or L.A. or Bahamas or wow. wherever they were.
How long did he stay with her?
About 3 years.
3 years.
Until she decided she wanted to be an actress and let the band go and quit touring.
She still plays a little every mm-hmm. once in a while. I've seen her somewhere, but yeah. not like she used to. Mm-hmm. Right? Well, that's yeah. an interesting story.
Hey, I want to thank Louise Key for sharing that interview with Saren Groom Knight.
As always, we have to thank our sponsors, Toothacres Pet Care Center. For all your boarding needs, choose Toothacres, because Toothacres cares. And I also want to thank you, the listener, for giving us your time and attention. Share these shows out on all your social media and help us preserve memories of Dallas. Until next time, I'm your host, Chris Daly, reminding you that the best thing about memories is making them. So go out and make some memories.